Blog Talk Radio.
Morning to you. I guess it is kind of the morning for, at least if you have a sleep schedule like I do, it's the morning for you. On the West Coast, it is definitely the morning. I'd be interested to see the numbers on people on the West Coast who listen to the live show. It's got to be super low, because who the fuck wants to be up at 8 o'clock? That's what it is on the West Coast? It's 8 o'clock. Jesus, man. Who the fuck would want to listen to me at 8 o'clock in the morning? That's some crazy shit. I don't want to listen to me at 8 o'clock in the morning. I have a superb show for you today. I have a splendiferous show for you today. Is that a word? I don't know. But it should be one. So maybe I just made it up. I have a splendiferous show for you. I got some good news from President Obama. I'm going to lead with that in a second. I got some bad news coming out of Florida, coming out of Flo-rida. Michael Savage, right-wing radio host, who I once dubbed the craziest right-wing radio host in the country, he's back, and he yet again proves that I was right to give him that title. And I don't know, man. Get off my back. I got a bunch of other shit here to talk about as well. Do you want to hear it or do you not want to hear it? Stop arguing with me. All right, let's get started. And we go to the good news, yet again, from President Obama. Man, second-term Obama is quite a bit better than first-term Obama. I think we should all be a wee bit happy here with second-term Obama, and I'll explain why. We have some great news coming out of the White House, Reuters explains. President Obama shortened the prison sentences of 111 convicts serving time for drug-related offenses in his second round of clemency grants this month. Obama has now granted a total of 673 commutations during his presidency, more than the number granted by the 10 previous presidents combined as he seeks to reform the criminal justice system. So they go on to explain that the way that this round worked is that some people, it's not like they're being released immediately. Some people, it's just that they got their sentences cut in half. Now, again, we're talking about nonviolent drug offenders here. He knows all the details of the cases. I don't know all the details of the cases. So, you know, maybe he has a reason for saying, well, these people, I'll just cut their sentences in half as opposed to releasing them. But as a general rule, like I've told you guys from the beginning, if it was me in there, I would basically use all the authority I had to release all the nonviolent drug offenders that I could. Not only would I release the ones in federal prisons, which obviously he has the authority to do, but I would also try to twist arms to make the states release the nonviolent drug offenders that they held. So he doesn't have the ability to say, okay, I'm going to commute a sentence or pardon somebody if they're held in state prisons. But what you can say is, you know, that's interesting. I see you have quite a few nonviolent drug offenders in there. Wouldn't it be weird if I cut your funding? And then what happens? The governors go, whoa, 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 whoa. Okay, we can work something out here, dog. Let's sit down. Let's have a conversation. You know, you wanna maybe cut their sentences a little bit or do this or do that, and then, you know, you get it accomplished that way. But look, the disagreements I have here are just around the edges because the reality is he deserves a hell of a lot of credit for what he's doing, and I've now concluded he gets it. On this issue, and this isn't to say it applies to other issues, but on this specific issue, President Obama gets it. And, you know, I guess he feels like, and there is pressure in this direction, too, if you think about it. It maybe the first black president doesn't want to be the one who has to, you know, release all the nonviolent drug offenders, because then what's going to happen? I mean, all the Republicans would say this either way, but they're going to go, the black guy, fucking people who do drugs, of course, you know how they are, you know? So, you know, perhaps there was he's hesitant in some ways, and he was earlier on because of that, which is understandable. But like I said, it now looks like he gets it. And if anything, the releasing of them, like, in increments might be a way to try to make it so that the news cycles don't, like, he released all the criminals, go crazy. Because that would happen, and it's probably still happening. I bet if you go to WorldNet Daily or Daily Caller or any of these other insane right-wing websites, they'll be like, Obama releases thugs and criminals, and the crime rate is going to spike. Now, again, I'm sure they'd leave out the details. These are nonviolent drug offenders, and they shouldn't fucking be in there in the first place. But I've concluded now that I think President Obama gets it because he keeps doing it. You know, it's one round after another round after another round, and then you go, he got it. I think he got it. So he's going to do as much as he possibly can. Now, maybe he's not going to go as far as I would go, like I said, where I would try to twist arms at the state level. But at the federal level, I'm now convinced he's working behind the scenes to do as much as he can. And that might mean even trying to put pressure on the DEA or the FDA or whatever agencies he has to try to get the scheduling of marijuana changed. I think he's using his prosecutorial discretion with this stuff and trying to, you know, make it so that the federal government does not go after the individual states that have decided, okay, we're going to legalize weed. So this is good. This is a good sign. And you have to call it for what it is. Second-term Obama has been significantly better than first-term Obama. Whether you're talking about this or the Cuba deal or the Iran deal or the immigration executive order or the overtime rules. So he's done a lot of things that deserve our credit. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm still going to attack him when he's wrong, and he's wrong quite a bit. I mean, he's expanded the NSA that restricts civil liberties even more. He hasn't yet, keyword, drawn a line in the sand on Guantanamo Bay and said, no, I'm not going to let this continue. You know, the drone war kills 90% civilians. He's done interventions in 7 different countries. And yes, in some respects, he's been kind of a sellout to Wall Street, just like all the other presidents, when he let some provision slide by in bills that he signed. So don't get me wrong here. It's not all good. It's not all bad. But you have to be objective and fair. And on this particular issue, it appears like he gets it and he's doing the right thing. And what I'm here to tell Obama is, dude, don't stop. I mean, if you really want, because I know presidents, they're narcissistic, obviously, and it's a difficult job. And, okay, you want your name in the history books. Well, obviously, it's already there. But if you want to have, you know, just glowing, fawning praise of you, well, one thing you could do is be the guy who says, I'm done with this nonsense. I mean, think about how crazy it is. That's why some people call it the new Jim Crow, that we lock up nonviolent drug offenders, and obviously to disproportionately people of color. You know, what you're doing is the functional equivalent of taking somebody who drinks a Corona or has a glass of whiskey and locking them up. I mean, you would think, if somebody did that right now, we go, oh, this is like the biggest restriction of freedom and liberty I've ever seen. This is a police state authoritarian government. That's insane. They're just tweaking their consciousness. They're getting drunk a little bit. So what? They're blowing off some steam. Who gives a shit? So we say that about that, but then all of a sudden, woo, don't tell me, oh, are you taking some illegal pills? Are you smoking some weed? Is that cocaine? What are you doing over there? Is that some sort of opiate? No, well, now I'm going to lock you up and throw away the key. Oh, well, that's just so stupid. And then also, you know, this breeds hatred against cops because cops have to enforce these stupid laws, and so they're an occupying force in many different communities. And, you know, you've given them a green light to basically do unconstitutional searches and seizures that violate the Fourth Amendment, and then they lock people up for just having a little bit of drugs on them. That's fucking crazy. If you get rid of that aspect of policing and you only have the police get involved when there's a violent crime happening, people would love the police. They go, oh, yeah, those guys who show up when there's a fucking assault or there's a murder or there's a rape and they save the day, yeah, oh, yeah, I hate them. How it'd be super hard to hate the cops if you took away the fuel that is the drug war, because the drug war makes it that they're going to harass you and they're going to try to, okay, what do you have? Do you have weed on you? Okay, well, now I got to lock you up. If they were just fucking there to prevent the worst of the worst crimes, everybody would be like, oh, the cops, awesome. So, again, and that's just a whole other aspect to the story that we don't need to get into, but credit to President Obama for what he's doing. And my message to him is continue. Don't let anybody stop you. All the advisors who are going to give you the bullshit Democratic strategist talking points of, well, no, you want to be a little careful because it's an election year and you want to appear to be centrist and moderate. Tell them to fuck right off, They don't know what they're talking about. If you listen to them, it hurts you. It doesn't help you. President Obama doing the right thing. That is good. That is good. That's my song. And by the way, this is another reason why I say I am convinced that whoever replaces Obama, whether it's Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, will be worse than Obama. That's going to happen. There's no doubt. No doubt. And it's so sad that we're having an election right now, and it's like guaranteed to be a change in the wrong direction, no matter what. Because I think Hillary, you know what, maybe I'm being slightly unfair to Hillary. There's a 5% chance or a 10% chance she is just literally a continuation of Obama, in which case, okay, I'll fucking take it. But it's really more likely that she's further to the right than him. And there's also a chance that she's way further to the right of him. So that would be a disaster. And Donald Trump, I mean, the fucking fascist buffoon, if you trust that guy and you think he's going to do anything progressive or for the people, you're an idiot. Like, you got to read all the stories on him and see how much of a joke he's been in his entire life and how big of a liar he is. And you know that he doesn't give a fuck about you. Even the core of his campaign, oh, the money, I'm not taking the money. Well, you are taking the money. What do you mean you're not taking the money? We see you're taking the fucking money. What are you talking about? Oh, I'm against TPP. I'm against it. Oh, really? You're against it? Well, then why is it that you have your own shit made in Turkey, your own shit made in Mexico, your own shit made in China? Nobody forced you. Nobody said, hey, Donald, you have to have your goods made overseas. You chose to have it made overseas. You chose that as you chastise others for choosing the same. So don't tell me, oh, make America great again. You couldn't even make America great again through your own policies. You'd rather hire people from other countries than people in the U.S., so spare me. Okay, now let's all get together and cry as we talk about Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Debbie Wasserman Schultz defeated progressive primary challenger Tim Canova in her district in Florida. She had about 57% of the vote. Tim Canova was able to raise over $3 million by running a Bernie Sanders-like campaign, yet grassroots people just funneling money to his campaign because they realized, oh, Debbie's horrific, and she's the epitome of an establishment insider who doesn't care about us. So let's go for this guy, Tim Canova. Well, in the end, Bernie endorsed him, but never ended up going down there and actually campaigning for him. That may have hurt him a little. Debbie raised about the same amount of money, but she also had Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, John Lewis, and Gabby Giffords campaign and fundraise with her. And, of course, Obama endorsed her as well. So she hung on. She hung on because she's the incumbent. She hung on because she had all this star power behind her. And she also hung on because, I mean, let's keep it real and call it what it is. The media has utterly failed us across the board, but specifically when it comes to the issue of these establishment Democrats. And also, look, I'm not absolving the voters. I'm not absolving the people in this situation. It is also incumbent upon them to, you know, learn about your different options, learn about Tim Canova, learn about Debbie Wasserman Schultz, make an informed decision about who's good and who's bad and who will represent the people and who won't. And they just didn't do that. So the media did a poor job educating people, of course, but then also the people themselves have to take responsibility too. Honestly, it should have been one of the easiest races in the country. It should have been, because there's so much information out there about Debbie Wasserman Schultz and just how big of a disaster she is, and people still voted for her. You know, and in a sense, maybe this is a more extreme example, but in a sense, I compare this to Representative Scott Desjarlais of Tennessee. I don't know if you guys remember him. He's a guy who ran a campaign on family values, of course, big-time Republican. And we found out that he made his wife and his mistress, stay classy, have abortions, multiple, plural. So he made them have abortions. He was also a doctor, and he prescribed drugs just so that his mistresses could get high. And this is a guy who, we knew all this about him, cheated with multiple women, made them have abortions, and gave prescriptions for so people could get high. He got reelected in a landslide. Multiple times. In the same way you look at the Tennessee voters and you go, you guys are fucking stupid. Like, no, seriously. There's like, you're either so insanely ignorant that there's an argument you shouldn't even go to the fucking ballot box, or you're just stupid. Because I care about family values. I'm a Tennessee Republican voter, and that's what I care about. All I care, I'm against abortion. I'm for Christian values, family values. All right, I'm going to vote for the guy who forced his wife and his mistress to have an abortion, and he likes to get high by giving pills to people because he's a doctor and whatnot. And by the way, he was also caught with marijuana. Stay classy. So this is exactly what happened. It's just the Democratic version in Florida. Where you couldn't, again, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, you just do one Google search, and what do you find? Oh, I don't know, maybe the fact that she is a stooge for the predatory payday lender industry. I mean, we were pulling our hair out over this story. You had Elizabeth Warren, and you had actual progressive Democrats pushing to try to regulate these predatory payday lenders. Debbie Wasserman Schultz steps in at the last minute on their behalf and goes, you know, maybe we take these rules
and we delay them a few years.
Oh, me? On the side of the predatory payday lenders? No. Oh, look at that. I took so much money from the predatory payday lenders. This is Debbie Wasserman Schultz. So, and the thing is, it's on a whole other level. It's so much more egregious than other politicians, too, because, you know, it's actually rare Democrats even take money from predatory payday lenders. Don't get me wrong, they almost all take it from Wall Street banks, just like the Republicans, and that's terrible. But the predatory payday lenders, a lot of the Democrats are like, you know, that's a step too far. They're very predatory. So we can't even pretend like we're looking out for the people if we're taking money from the fucking payday loan industry. Debbie's like, I don't give a fuck. Sign me up, bitch. Give me my money. And then look what ends up happening. She ends up defending them and helping them and succeeding in doing so. Debbie Wasserman Schultz for you. How can anybody look at that and go, oh, yeah, let's go for her again? And then probably the biggest point, the elephant in the room here is, she helped rig a primary against Bernie Sanders and for Hillary Clinton. She rigged the Democratic process. People are like, yeah, let's go for her. What? How is that a thing? How is that an option? How is that on the table? There are fucking emails. She emailed people at MSNBC and said, yeah, this must stop. You must stop bashing me on air. Oh, that's nice. So you don't believe in the fucking First Amendment either or the Constitution. You know, Chuck Todd, let me tell you something. Those people on Morning Joe are being a little too harsh on me. Somebody needs to have a strong word for them. I'm going to your superior. I'm going to Phil Griffin. Right? It is Phil Griffin for MSNBC. I think it is. I'm going to Phil, and I'm going to tell him that this is bad.
Debbie, you're a fucking politician. You're in Congress. You're not allowed to do that. You can't say the media needs to shut up about me. What the fuck? Are you openly fascist? Is that what the fuck you are? That is what you are. That's what you're asking. You're being authoritarian. I need you to stop criticizing me. Who does that? Somebody who doesn't understand our system of government and only cares about herself and her power and her image. And then remember all the internal DNC emails. Well, how can we create a narrative against Bernie Sanders? Well, he's leading in the polls in Kentucky and West Virginia. How about we leak the fact that he might be an atheist and we try to atheist shame him and let play up Hillary's religious side, and then maybe that'll help her win in those states. Wouldn't that be great? This was all the DNC under her. This is an epic disaster, and honestly, it makes me lose hope a little bit. It does. So, again, it's on the media for not doing a better job covering her and explaining, okay, look what she did with the predatory payday lenders. Hello, warning sign. Hello, look what happened with the fucking the email leaks and the fact that we know that she was biasing the election in favor of Hillary Clinton. So they didn't do a good enough job covering that. And also, you got to put the blame on the people. You know, people could cry and yelp and bitch and moan, oh my God, our government's terrible, and they're right, it's not representing you. But then when you have an opportunity to oust one of the worst offenders, you're like... It's a sad, sad day. And then on top of it, I should also throw in a mention for this. You know who else lost yesterday in a Democratic primary? Alan Grayson. Alan Grayson, loathed by Harry Reid and the Democratic establishment. He's running against Patrick Murphy, another epitome of an establishment insider Democrat. And we covered the story recently. You know what Patrick Murphy's daddy did? He gave, I don't know if it was $1 million or $2 million, but he gave a metric fuck ton of money to make sure that his son won re-election, and it worked, and Alan Grayson got kicked to the curb. Now, Alan Grayson was in Congress, and then he was running for the Senate this time,
And again, this was the primary. So it's going to be Patrick Murphy versus Marco Rubio. By the way, I really think that Patrick Murphy has a chance of losing to Marco Rubio. Rubio's up in the polls. I don't think if it was Alan Grayson versus Marco Rubio, I don't think Marco Rubio would stand a fucking chance. The polls right now might show that, oh, Marco would beat Alan Grayson. Alan Grayson knows how to run a fucking campaign, and he knows how to win. Did you know that the last election, when the Democrats got their clocks cleaned, across the board, what happened? Alan Grayson won in a landslide. Why? Because he ran a campaign saying, yeah, I'm a fucking liberal. I don't give a shit. Suck it. Yeah, I'm proud. I'm proud to be a liberal, and I'm going to argue for these policies. You disagree with me? How about you're the moron? How about that? So he ran that campaign, won overwhelmingly in an election where all the mealy-mouthed, centrist, moderate Democrats got destroyed. You know, the perfect example of that is Alison Lundergan Grimes. She ran in Kentucky, and Mitch McConnell beat her. Mitch McConnell, who has unfavorables of roughly 43 quadrillion, won and beat Alison Lundergan Grimes. She lost. So what does that show you? You got to be progressive. You got to be aggressive. Alan Grayson was that, but he lost because his challenger, Patrick Murphy, got daddy's money in there and was able to spend so much more and get his name out there so much more and create the narrative so much more. And so we lost Grayson, and we also lost Canova. We never had Canova, but Debbie Wasserman Schultz now staying in there. And not a good day. Not a good day. Okay. All right, let me do one more here, and then we'll take a break. Reuters has a story here on Obama's Supreme Court pick. And it shows that the GOP is starting to budge. So they say U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley opened the door to holding a hearing on Obama Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland if a majority of senators wish to do so after the November 8th election. Grassley, an Iowa Republican, vowed months ago that the Senate Judiciary Committee he chairs would not act this year to consider Garland's nomination, saying the Republican Majority Senate should not act on a court nominee until after the new president takes office early next year. But in a town hall meeting Monday in Cherokee, Iowa, Grassley indicated that he could be persuaded by a large number of senators to take action in a lame duck session between the November 8th election and the inauguration of the new president in January. So I told you this was going to happen. The Republicans were so extreme and so obstinate and so closed off to having any Supreme Court pick from Obama fill Justice Scalia's seat that they said, it's just off the table. We're not going to do it. We're not going to do our jobs. And they promised to block longer than anybody has ever blocked in the history of the United States of America. Literally. They're like, we're not even going to have the hearings. So it's not even like they have the hearings and then they block everything. They're like, no, we're nipping it in the bud, not even having any hearings. Never mind approving whoever the fuck we eventually do have hearings about. So he said, we're just going to ride out the rest of your term, break a record in terms of obstruction, and then whoever the next president is, we'll let them pick. Now, I told you at the time, you think that's really what they're going to do? No, what's way, way more likely is you stake out this unreasonable position, and then what will Obama do? Obama doesn't fight fire with fire. Obama, on many issues, cannot wait to cave to the Republicans. So what does he do? He's like, first let me pick a Republican to fill the seat. Oh, what are you doing? Don't do that. Now, this was a moderate Republican, and then I think his name is Sandoval, and he didn't want the job. So they go, okay, well, we just floated this idea. And then he goes, let's go with Merrick Garland. Now, Merrick Garland is a giant mixed bag. He's not somebody you would hope a Democratic president would pick. So he's good on some issues like the First Amendment. He's good on environmental issues. And he's good on some campaign finance stuff, though I certainly wouldn't say all. But he's incredibly conservative on criminal justice issues, on Guantanamo Bay, on due process. So Fourth Amendment issues, he would be conservative. Drug issues, he would be conservative. So this is a guy who you don't want a Democratic president picking this person, because think about it. When we have Republican presidents, who do they pick? People like Scalia. They pick people who are insanely right-wing. Then you have a Democratic president, who do they pick? People who are 50-50. Center-right, maybe centrist at best. So when do we ever get liberal picks? We don't. We just don't. So, I told you at the time, what's going to happen is Obama's going to pick somebody that the Republicans are kind of going to like. And, in fact, we've read you quotes on air before of all the different Republicans saying, oh, we actually love Merrick Garland. This was back, you know, when he was on a different court with different cases, and when they were proving him for a different court, they go, oh, this guy's great. I don't know what you're talking about. This guy's wonderful. This guy's as much with us as you could possibly be from a Democratic pick. So all these guys loved him, supported him, thought he was awesome not that long ago, and now they're all going, oh, I am mad. Let me huff and puff. I am angry. We need to not approve anybody Obama picks. And Obama's like, well, how about if I give you exactly who you want? And they're like, no, we are still not going to approve him. We don't even want to have hearings. And now finally, they're realizing it. See, somebody went up to these Republicans and whispered in their ear, he's actually giving you somebody you want, so just go with it. And then eventually they'll turn around and go, I guess we'll have hearings. Whoops, I guess we approved them. And Obama will go, aha, I gotcha. But in reality, no, he got. Because I just described to you, when you have Republican presidents, you get insanely far right-wing picks. When you have Democratic presidents, you get centrist or center-right picks. You never get a liberal. When the fuck do you get a liberal? When do you get a liberal? Now, every once in a while, we happen to get lucky and have somebody who, you know, portrays themselves as a centrist, and then they are fairly liberal on the court. You could argue Justice Kagan is like that, for example. But this shows you that as Obama's being played, he thinks, I'm playing them. And on too many issues, it's like this with the Republicans, and it's sad to watch. The other hilarious part of this is they go on to say they fear that Hillary would pick a far-left justice. Oh, that is cute. That is fucking adorable. She already said that she would leave Merrick Garland up there. So, like, I don't know what you guys are talking about. She's already admitting that she wouldn't pick a far-left justice. All right, let me take a break. When we come back, a whole bunch more stuff, including right-wing commentators lose their goddamn minds and melt down over Trump, and they're attacking each other. What an awesome story. Yeah.
Welcome back.
Welcome back. Welcome back. All right, let's have some fun. I have right-wing commentators here. fighting each other. Glorious. Absolutely glorious. Right-wing commentators are losing their minds and fighting each other over Donald Trump. So first here, you're going to listen to Hannity. Hannity goes after Beck. And then Mark Levin chimes in at the end and gives his take on the whole hashtag Never Trump movement. Let's listen.
So here's what I say to all of you Never Trumpers. Glenn Beck, I hope you're listening.
Oh.
You owned Hillary Clinton's Supreme Court appointment.
Ooh,
bitch. You own it. You are doing everything you can do to cast doubt in people's minds. Trump gave us a list. You own her Supreme Court nominees. You own the unvetted refugees and the 550% increase you will bring into this country. You own the jobs that illegal immigrants will take from the 95 million Americans out of the labor force. You own Obamacare, which is a disaster for this country. You own education because she's beholden to the NEA. And if we don't improve the lives of 95 million Americans out of the labor force, I blame you for that too, because you're helping elect her. And I'm also saying that, hey, we have a $4,100 increase in health care payments since Obama's been president. It's only going to go higher. You get responsibility for that, too. We've got 12 million more Americans on food stamps. If that increases, I'm going to blame you.
If only the Never Trumpers, if only Jonah Goldberg and Bill Kristol and Glenn Beck and this one and that one, if only they get behind Trump, then we'd be winning. We'd win big time. Oh, yes. No, we wouldn't.
Oh, shit, nigga.
As popular as many of those men and women are, they're not going to sway anybody one way or another. This is a presidential election. People make up their own minds. I can encourage you or others to do one thing or another. In the end, you're going to make up your own mind, which is exactly Ted Cruz's point. You're going to vote your conscience. You're going to decide yourself. That's a statement of fact. Railing on and on, positioning yourself. I will announce, I said, after Labor Day, my vote with respect to Trump. I will announce it. But I'm not a Pollyanna.
What does that mean?
I'm not a Pollyanna. The fact of the matter is, maybe Trump will win. Maybe Hillary will be stopped. But we nominated the wrong person.
Mark Levin.
Oh, the radio guys are so goofy. Mark Levin. Drama. You gotta put shit like that in there to create the drama that you lack because you're fucking boring. Mark Levin. Okay. I would have sympathy for the Never Trump people if it wasn't the case that every single one of them fervently supports Ted Cruz. So I've said it from the beginning. Donald Trump is a hideous fascist buffoon, but Ted Cruz is worse because not only does he have all of Donald Trump's downsides, on top of all of it, he wants to basically set up the Christian Saudi Arabia and have us live in a theocracy. He's smarmy, he's fake, he's a liar. Trump is all those things too, in his own right, in a different way. He's got the fake straight shooter thing going on. You know, Cruz kind of wears his used car salesman-ness on his sleeve. But they're the same in that respect. The only difference is Cruz wants to sprinkle on top of it Christian theocracy. So he is worse. So all these guys were like, you know, I'm Mark Levin, and I'm so principled, and I'm a real conservative. So Ted Cruz better. We nominated the wrong person. And the hilarious thing is, like, these guys really think, whether it's Glenn Beck or Mark Levin, If we had only nominated Ted Cruz, well, then we'd beat Hillary in a landslide. No. No. Not even close. In fact, of all of the different Republican contenders, Trump had and has the best shot, even though he's still down today, down about 5 points in the most recent polls nationally to Hillary Clinton. But he's keeping it close in some swing states. Ohio's one example. But yeah, no, Ted Cruz would be blown out way more than Donald Trump. Way more. Way more. Because Ted Cruz is like Rick Santorum. That's what he is. He's this election cycle's Rick Santorum, even though Rick Santorum ran in this election too. Weird. But he's like Mike Huckabee or Rick Santorum, just way too creepy, religious, and smarmy, and fake, and, you know, a down-the-line far right-winger. That's going to play over worse than Trump. As much shit as Trump gets, Trump, at least he keeps hammering TPP. I don't think he's actually against it. His actions show he's outsourced his own goddamn jobs. But at least he keeps hammering it in his rhetoric, and he says, I'm not going to cut Social Security. Fucking Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz were out there like, yeah, we need to cut Social Security. Now vote for us. Nobody's going to want to fucking vote for you. Even the right-wing base is like, no, I like my Social Security, asshole. But these guys, like Glenn Beck and Mark Levin, they're like, we should have went with Cruz. I like how my Mark Levin impression and my Ted Cruz impression is very similar. They both sound like whiny little punk bitches. I'm Ted Cruz, me. I'm Mark Levin. I'm so intellectual. My really weird voice proves it. No, it doesn't. And to Sean Hannity, so I'm going after Beck and Levin here, but I'm not letting Hannity off the hook because Hannity is such a fucking dense moron that he seriously does not get that with Hillary Clinton, you're getting a fairly conservative president. In fact, as far as Democrats go, you're almost as right-wing as you can get in the party. Now some people go, oh, come on. Well, look, maybe Evan Bayh is an example, or some of the Blue Dog Democrats. Okay, they're more right-wing. Joe Manchin. And that's a fair point. So there are a few who are to her right. But, dude, she voted for the Iraq War. You love the Iraq War. If I'm not mistaken, I think you masturbated to the Iraq War live on air. Okay, that's not true. But I could imagine it being true. He pushed for Iraq War for the Iraq War nonstop. The Patriot Act. You went on a crusade against all people who were against the Patriot Act, saying they want a tax against America, and the Patriot Act is the only way to keep us safe. And if you support the Patriot Act, you're a patriot. If you don't, you hate America. These are arguments that Hannity made on a regular basis. Well, Hillary was with you. She voted for the Patriot Act. Hillary, of course, supported NAFTA. She supported deregulation. These are all right-wing policy ideas. Free market ideas. You used to cheerlead this shit nonstop. You scoffed at protectionism. You scoffed at regulating Wall Street and regulating industry in the country. So Hillary was with you on that. She was for intervention in Libya and Syria. Again, you were the biggest hawk in the world when Bush was in office. There wasn't an intervention on the planet you didn't want to do. But now, all of a sudden, okay, I'm going to pretend like Hillary is so wild and so out there and so liberal and so bad. Well, she's only bad if you're bad, dipshit, because on so many main issues, she agreed with you. But that's the thing. With Hannity, it's similar like with the story we did with Limbaugh the other day. It's not about substance with these guys. It never was about the policy specifics. They play for a team. They play for a team. So Hannity, Team Trump. It's just what he is. Rush Limbaugh, Team Trump. It's just what he is. Contradictions, I don't give a fuck about contradictions. I might contradict myself on a daily basis. I don't give a fuck. I'm pro-Trump no matter what he's for. If he changes his mind, I change my mind. How about that? And you have Beck and Levin and the rest of them. They're Team Cruz. And it's ride or die Team Cruz. So there's no criticism of their dear leader. And some people, this is where some people would do a false equivalent and say, well, you guys were like that with Bernie. No, not true at all. In fact, I could tell you multiple areas where I disagree with Bernie. For fuck's sake, he did apologetics for the drone program. Okay, there's one. I disagree with Bernie on drones. There you go. How about he never mentioned a word about legalizing all drugs. He only spoke about marijuana. I disagree with him on that. I would legalize all drugs, legalize, tax, and regulate all drugs. Gambling, Never heard him utter a peep about, you know, legalizing gambling. That's something I would do. Legalizing sex work and prostitution. That's something I would do. The list goes on and on. I can point to a million areas where I disagree with Bernie Sanders, and I'm willing to talk about that. These guys, oh, forget it. Had you trying to find Hannity disagreeing with Trump? Good luck. Trying to find Beck disagreeing with Cruz? Good luck. Not going to happen. So it is glorious watching these right-wingers melt down trying to defend their daddies. Okay. Okay, now let's go to Robert Reich, former Treasury Secretary, excuse me, for an interesting article he has. Robert Reich, the former Treasury Secretary and a Bernie Sanders supporter, had a really interesting article he posted. It quotes a conversation between him and a friend, and I wanted to share it with you here because it basically shines light on what do we do after this election. So he says, I got a call from a friend in Washington who knows more about political polling than anyone in America. He was almost breathless with excitement. It's going to be a landslide, he said. In which direction? I joked. Hillary's going to win in places we haven't won in years, Georgia, Nevada, Arizona. She'll take the entire West, the whole East Coast. Trump is sinking like a stone. So do we get the Senate back? You bet. 60 votes? No, but a nice majority. And the House? We won't win it back, but Democrats will get 14 of the 30 they need. So still a Republican majority, but far weakened. And what about the states? He paused. The states? Will we take back the states? No, the GOP will remain in control in most states. So the only part of government that will change hands is the U.S. Senate, and not even by enough to overcome a filibuster. Yes, he said, as if I had taken the air out of his balloon. And what about all the people who'll be voting for Trump? What about them, he asked cautiously. After Trump loses, they'll still be out there. Right? Of course. And they'll be madder than hell. Poisoned with Trump's venom, they'll be a ready-made constituency for the next demagogue. And then he goes on to say, remind me to never call you again with good news. So, you know, the moral of the story here is, it's not over, it's never over. And by the way, it should be an extra level of obvious that it's not over if fucking Hillary Clinton wins. The absolute best-case scenario, best-case scenario, and this is only like a 5% chance, maybe 10% chance, is that if Hillary Clinton wins, she acts exactly like Obama. Then Obama's been a mixed bag, and then, okay, President Hillary Clinton's a mixed bag. That's the best-case scenario. What's much more realistic is that she's further to the right than Obama, which Obama's already uncomfortably right for somebody like myself, for my tastes. So the idea that, like, okay, well, we defeated Trump, and haha, that's great, you don't think there's going to be another Trump? Of course there's going to be another Trump. You want to know why? Trump doesn't exist in a vacuum. Trump exists in the context of a country that, number one, has right-wingers who were fed Fox News for, you know, over a decade now. So that's affected this. And also, these are people who, along with just being pumped up with stupid ideas, they also are genuine victims of a corrupt system that has benefited the establishment and the elite and the wealthy and fucked them over. I mean, this is reflected in, you know, the way wages have been going for decades now. Since the 1980s, wages have been stagnant. You don't think people feel like, oh, we got to change something, we got to do something, we got to, you know, we need something different, I need to feel like I have a shot to climb up this ladder of opportunity. People don't feel like they have that opportunity right now because they largely don't. I mean, you know, Canada surpassed us in terms of that. Now the American dream is the Canadian dream. There was a study about that about a year ago that we covered. I mean, we live in a country where 45,000 people die every year because they don't have access to basic health care. That's insanity. Medical bills is the number one cause of bankruptcy. We have student loan debt of over $1 trillion. I mean, the idea that, like, no, Trump will go away and there will never be another Trump and people will keep voting for the establishment candidate. No, right-wing populism is now a new thing that should fucking keep you up at night because
They're tapping into something real, anger at the establishment, which is legitimate, but they're proposing all the wrong solutions. Xenophobia, bigotry, increased authoritarianism, scapegoating. But those seem like reasonable answers to people who've been beat down by the system over all these years. So it ain't over. It's never over. And the bottom line is the left-wing populace need to beat the right-wing populace. We need to be more mobilized, we need to be more engaged, and we need to be ready to take them on. And I don't know if that's the case. And, you know, it's weird because with this election, a million things can happen, and we don't know. So, for example, if Trump wins, historically it is true that if you get, a right-wing extremist like him in power, it's not the case necessarily that the left-wing, you know, bands together and then we can fight back and be a unified opposition. I know that's a theory that a lot of people have. But historically, what happened during the Reagan years, for example? He just permanently pushed the country further right and moved the entire Overton window to the right and got us disastrous policies that helped fuck over the middle class, as I was just alluding to. So you got this insane right-winger, and it wasn't the case that, oh, the pendulum's going to swing far back in the other direction. No, it just permanently shifted the spectrum to the right. So that could happen with Trump. Probably likely to happen if Trump wins. But then, yes, it also is a possibility that people go, that's so far that now we do want to swing the pendulum back to the left. So you could have a progressive awakening under Trump. It's a possibility. Again, I don't think it's likely based on historical evidence, but it could happen. And then the opposite is also true. So if you get Hillary Clinton, you know, you could permanently, I was going to say shift the spectrum to the left, but we all know she's not going to move it to the left that far. If anything, best case scenario, she's exactly like Obama. Again, that's best case scenario. So you continue the establishment, direction, and then you could have the right-wing populace mobilize stronger, and then we have a whole new set of problems with the next Trump. So if Hillary wins, you know, you can avoid the worst disaster in Trump, or you could just be delaying the next disaster and the next Trump. And if the Trump wins, you could either permanently push the spectrum even further right, or you could have the progressive awakening. What I want to see happen is to avoid the worst case scenario, which I do think is a Trump presidency, because he's so unhinged and he's so crazy that you don't know what he would do. And that's not a guy you can trust with an army and the nuclear launch codes. And he has crazy ideas about economics, and I'll make a deal, bankrupt the country and make a deal, which would push us into a global depression. So, but what I want to see is you avert the worst case scenario. So you avert Donald Trump, but then you still have a progressive awakening that forces Hillary to the left. And if she doesn't go to the left, then yeah, we kick her ass to the curb and we try to get the next Bernie Sanders in there. Not necessarily Bernie Sanders himself, but whoever the next Bernie Sanders is with the next progressive campaign. So I'd like to, at every step of the way, go as far left as we possibly could, because the far left in America really is just the center internationally. And Robert Reich is kind of hinting at that here when he says, look, the work is never done. The work is never done. Oh, you think a Hillary Clinton landslide? Like, oh, yay, we won. What does that even mean? We won. Hillary Clinton is a fucking vanilla, moderate, center-right, pro-corporate, pro-establishment shill. Oh, yeah, we won. Okay, Team Blue won. And then? So you averted a worse disaster, but we still have a disaster, just a smaller disaster in Hillary. The work is never done. We got to stay mobilized, we got to keep fighting, and we have to do systemic reform and push this country further to the left. Okay. All right, let me do one more. And this will be, you know what, let me pause on that one. Pause on Chris Christie, too. I'm just trying to find the right order to do this in. Okay, let's do this one on the healthcare system. This one is fairly quick. A new study published in the journal Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy found that U.S. citizens are taking antibiotics that are made for their pets. Oh, that's lovely. So Raw Story reports here, the study, which surveyed 400 respondents in Houston, tracked how they acquired the medications, with 24% saying they bought their antibiotics outside the country, 20% citing friends or relatives as their source, 12% saying they conserved their antibiotics from prior prescriptions. CNN noted that 4% of respondents voluntarily stated that they used drugs that were originally prescribed to animals, a response that was not among the options listed on the survey. Now, understand something, guys. People overusing antibiotics is actually a separate issue, because they try to stress in this article and make clear that, no, we're talking about people here who needed antibiotics. So, separate issue and a big issue, to be clear, of antibiotic overuse, because then that leads to drug-resistant bacteria, and then, you know, we're in a whole nother ball game and a whole nother world of hurt when we have even our best antibiotics can't take out these superbugs. So that's a separate problem. But they're saying here, this is an instance of people who need antibiotics. And they're like, okay, I really can't afford this. So what am I going to do? Well, I just described it to you. I don't know, use a friend, use old ones that I had, maybe that are ineffective at this point, or use ones for animals. Think about that. Now, animals metabolize things differently, and so that's why antibiotics are different. They're pet antibiotics and not human antibiotics. People are like, I don't care, I'm going to take it because I can't afford regular ones. So I'll take these and just hope it works. Oh, God. Guys, this is the state of our healthcare system. People need antibiotics, or they need medication. Like, I can't afford it. I'm not able to do it. So I just got to try this. Oh, I mean, this is a story that you think would come out of a second world country, a third world country. Like, well, that's what we got to do. This is the United States of America. And when you think about just all the resources that we're squandering, you go, oh, no. Oh, no, what the fuck is up with our priorities, man? So, for example, we spent $7 trillion by the year 2053 when you add the interest and when all is said and done in the Iraq war. $7 trillion. And this is the case here at home. Like, our infrastructure is crumbling. It gets a grade of D-. We can't fucking get clean water in many places around the U.S. People are taking pet antibiotics because they can't afford regular antibiotics. And we're wasting fucking trillions on an unnecessary war, an offensive war against a country that didn't attack us. We're spending billions upon billions to create new fighter jets to find a way to bomb shit in a more efficient way. $4 billion a year for a subsidy for ExxonMobil, a corporate welfare check to help them do research and development, even though they're one of the most profitable corporations on the planet. We're spending over $80 billion for money just given to the bank. Oh, just given to the financial institutions. Hey, here's $80 billion. What the fuck is that about? So we're doing corporate welfare nonstop. Over 50% of our discretionary spending is military spending. We're funding 800 military bases, which cost billions of dollars around the globe. And meanwhile, at home, everything's fucking falling apart. Everything's falling apart. What a sad state of reality, man. You know, if we can find the money to do unnecessary wars of aggression that cost trillions, if we can find the money for all this corporate welfare, if we can find the money for needless pork barrel projects, you know, I think we can find the money for antibiotics for our people. I think we can find the money for having a better healthcare system overall, for having a single-payer system, for eliminating student loan debt, and maybe having free college. You know, when you're prioritizing what you spend your money on in a country, shouldn't, like, in the top five of things you spend on be healthcare and education? But the U.S. is like, yeah, fuck that. Fuck that. Imperialism is better. Let's spend money on war, endless war. And our buddies in suits and ties who are corrupt and gave us money to get elected, we give them corporate welfare checks all day long. How about that? No, how about you're stealing from the American people? That's our money. These are our resources. And you're squandering them. And this is why Congress, for example, always has like a 9% approval rating, even right after they get elected. So people elect them, and then a month later, they're like, yeah, you know, we don't like them. Because everybody knows we're picking from the lesser of two evils. God, they're so insular in their own fucking bubble, and they're so clueless as to how much hatred they're stirring up around the country. I mean, our government has been hijacked by special interests and by corporations, and we have to stop it. And, this is just another stark reminder when people are taking fucking pet antibiotics because they have a real medical issue. Okay. Got to take a break when we come back. The Hill has an interesting article here that verifies something we've been saying a while about Republican states. And Chris Christie vetoed a minimum wage increase because, of course, we'll talk about that and much more. Stay right there. Got some more for you. The Hill has an interesting article here that verifies something we've been saying for a while based on other studies and other articles. They report, states that voted against President Obama twice are more dependent on the federal government, according to an analysis of new data released by the Pew Charitable Trusts on Monday. All told, the average state that voted against Obama twice relied on federal funding for an average of 33.8% of its budget, the report found. Among the 27 states that voted for Obama twice, federal grants made up 29.9% of the average state budget. Republican states rely more heavily on federal dollars as a share of their budgets than do more Democratic states, largely because southern states especially are more likely to have a higher percentage of residents living in poverty. Now, stop and think about this and how it flips the stereotype on its head. Remember what Mitt Romney said when he thought the cameras weren't on? You know, 47% of the country, they're never going to take personal responsibility. They're never going to be hard workers. They're never going to take care of themselves. So I'm going to write off that part of the country. I'm not trying to get their votes. I'm trying to get the other people. It was, you know, his big 47% comment. What argument was he making? Well, I mean, the Democrats. You know the Democrats. They're all lazy and poor, and they don't pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and they're not hard workers, and they're unemployed, and, you know, a lot of them are mooching black people. I didn't say it. No, I'm just saying 47% of the country are fucking lazy and don't work hard. I'm not saying it's black people. He's clear. He's saying, yeah, the Democrats, they're lazy. They don't work. They rely on other people to pay for them and take care of them. That's the argument he made. And this is, it's not just Mitt Romney. I mean, I'm unfairly picking on Mitt Romney here. It's not like he made that up. I mean, this is Rush Limbaugh 101, Sean Hannity 101, Ayn Rand 101. The idea that it's like, you know, the liberals, the fucking liberals, always want to do free stuff. Like, idiots, when we talk about let's have universal health care and universal, you know, education, for example, it's paid for with our tax dollars. So we work, we all work, you take a percentage of the money, and then, okay, let's prioritize this and spend it on intelligent things. Nobody's saying, hey, let's create one of these, a universal health care system and not pay for it. We're all willing to pay for it just through taxes as opposed to out of our pockets individually, where we get price gouged in a capitalist system and there's an unnecessary profit margin there and people fucking get rich off of the misery of others. Okay, so, but anyway, I'm getting sidetracked here. Bottom line is, find me a far right winger who doesn't think, oh, the Democrats, moochers, parasites, lazy. What they're saying here is no. According to the actual data, the facts, Republican states rely much more heavily on federal government subsidies. So they are net tax receivers way more than the blue states. So in other words, the blue states are more producers, and the red states are bigger takers. So if we were inclined to be assholes like them, you know, we can come out here, Republicans, they're all lazy, and they're all moochers, and they don't work, and they don't pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and they need to learn learn a lesson about life and how to live and how to do the right thing and how to actually get up and take some responsibility for yourself. Except, you know what? I'm not going to say that, because that's also not true. Because the reality is, the people who net receive federal tax money, these are all people who need to receive federal tax money, not because they're lazy or they're bad people. No, oftentimes the people who get our help are veterans, are senior citizens, are disabled people, you know, people who have various health issues. You know, these are the people who need our help. And oftentimes people end up getting help when they're working a full-time job and they're busting ass, but they still don't make enough money to survive. Well, I just described, those are more so Republicans. And it's shown in the data how it's the Republican states that get more help. But that's not, like, I'm not morally judging them based off that. The only thing I would ask them to do is not morally judge
black people and minorities and Democrats and say, well, come on, you're all lazy and you don't want to take responsibility. No, again, you know, most people are good people just working hard, trying to get ahead, and sometimes when you work a full-time job and the system is built so that a full-time job doesn't necessitate a living wage, a lot of people are left behind by the system and fucked over, not by any personal failing, but because the system by its nature is designed for people to fail even if they work hard in some instances. So, you know, it would just be nice if they stop with these simplistic views of the world, this black and white view of the world. Democrats, bad, lazy, moochers, parasites. Republicans, good, hard-working, God-fearing, lovely people, responsibility, yeah. It's not the way it works. There are plenty of bad people who are Republicans, plenty of bad people who are Democrats, plenty of good people who are Republicans, plenty of good people who are Democrats. And again, before you trot out that old stereotype again of, oh, lazy-ass Democrats, you know how they are, just remember, the data shows the exact opposite. So pump your brakes a little bit. Your stereotypes are factually incorrect. By the way, it's also true that if the South had more liberal policies as well, they would be better off. It's so funny. Like, Bill O'Reilly loves to do this trick where he says, Detroit, Democratic control, piece of shit city, therefore Democratic ideas are terrible for everybody, including the poor, and Republican ideas are wonderful. Okay, but Bill, you're using a micro example, a city. You ready for this? Let's use a bigger example. States, Mississippi, poorest state in the union, stridently Republican. I win. Like, he doesn't stop and think about it. But again, even that's not fair. The reality is, just like in Detroit, it was a right-wing policy that fucked him over. So it's the shipping out of all the jobs that were associated with the car industry. That's the problem, is that, you know, you had Republicans say, let's get our cars now made in Mexico and made overseas, and let's screw over the entire middle-class community here. That was the issue. But he just tries to paint it like, well, Democrats have controlled it, therefore it's their fault. No, no, no. Republicans control Mississippi. Republicans, by and large, control the South, and that's the poorest place in the country. So your analysis is flawed deeply. All right, Chris Christie, let's do it. Chris Christie vetoed a New Jersey minimum wage increase to $15 yesterday because, of course, he's Chris Christie. Why wouldn't he do that? So he said, all of this sounds great, raising the minimum wage, when you're spending someone else's money. It should bother you because when you come into Pennington Market, your food is going to be more expensive. He's kind of like Trump in that he's a stream of consciousness, but at no point is that actually making sense. What do you mean? Oh, you're spending someone else's money if you raise minimum wage. Huh? What? No, you're making the businesses pay their workers enough money to survive if they work full time. That wacky idea. So, but keep in mind for a second the way he framed this, because we're going to come back to that. He says the liberals want to spend other people's money. Okay. We'll see. We'll see about that. So let me give you some facts here so you understand just how preposterous his disagreement with increasing the minimum wage is. If the minimum wage simply up with inflation from the 1960s, you know what it would be today? $10.52 an hour. So in other words, if you worked in 1967, if you were working a minimum wage job, you technically made more money than you're making today if you work a minimum wage job. Isn't that an insane fact? I mean, it really is. The minimum wage in the 1960s is worth more than the minimum wage is worth today. Wowzers. Okay. So also, if the minimum wage kept up with productivity, so, you know, how hard you're actually working and how much you're actually producing, it would be $21.72 an hour.
Oh, isn't that amazing? Because, again, the Republicans love to say, why would we raise the minimum wage when raising the minimum wage means you're paying people more than what they're worth? You want to artificially increase the wages, you stupid lib? Well, actually, no. What you want to do is artificially keep wages low. Because if you go by productivity, it's $21.72 an hour. Oops. Okay, now, remember what I told you? Keep in mind Chris Christie's dumbass argument. I almost gave him a southern accent. You're spending somebody else's money. Of course liberals want to do it. You're spending somebody else's money. Stupid liberals. Okay, well, according to the Economic Policy Institute, quote, raising the federal minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to just $10.10 an hour. So even just a little increase here would save the U.S. government an estimated $7.6 billion every year. Whoa! So actually the exact opposite of what Chris Christie said is true. It's the Republicans who want to keep the wage artificially low. They're the ones who are fine with spending other people's money. Because what happens? When you pay somebody less than what they can live on, somebody's got to make up the difference. What are they just going to lose their house and not be able to feed themselves? We're just going to let them starve in the street? Is that how we're going to act? Is that what we're going to do? So if somebody makes up the difference, it turns out the federal government has to make up the difference through various government programs, through food stamps and other, you know, programs that people need, Medicaid, you name it, their wages, and make the businesses pay people what they're worth and pay them a living wage. Well, then you can cut those government programs, you dumbass, and save money on that end so the taxpayers save money. Now, Chris can turn around and argue, yeah, but then the price of the food will increase and the price of the goods will increase. Yes, but very little. They've done studies on this and they've reported on this, you know, ad nauseum. The reality is, like, for example, the average good at Walmart would be increased in price between 2 cents and 8 cents to pay the workers a living wage. That's it. That's it. So you got to pay 2 cents to 8 cents more, and in return, you no longer have wage slavery. Seems like a pretty good trade-off to me, don't you think? Like, oh, this person can now afford, you know, basic goods and live on that floor and work full-time but survive, and all I have to do is pay 5 cents more for this good? Yeah, totally fine with that, because I'm not a fucking savage or a barbarian or a cretin. You? All right, now we go to another right-wing radio host, somebody who was left out of our festivities earlier today, Michael Savage. And, oh, God, he's going to lose his fucking mind for us. Right-wing radio host Michael Savage is going to do a segment where he calls for a crusade against liberals if Trump wins, and it actually gets kind of dangerous here.
Of course, if she wins, it's all over. And I list them in scorched earth. Would you like to know the names of these extreme liberal progressive organizations? Some of them you will know. The American Civil Liberties Union, the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Southern Poverty Law Center. Oh, but there are many, many others that are clearly treasonous, in my opinion. The number one public enemy, page 85, the head of the serpent is the ACLU. It must be broken apart. Now, if I say that the way to do it is to start with the UAC, House of Un-American Activities Committee investigation, I know what's going to happen. The left wing will go insane. They'll say, Savage, you're violating our civil rights. They'll say you do not have probable cause to bring people in to investigate them. They might be right, but we need to do exactly that for our survival, I write. Tell me how a society that is open like ours, that is democratic like ours, can survive when enemies of freedom, enemies of democracy, are destroying society by using the very freedoms that we have in place because of the U.S. Constitution. What would you do? This is the conundrum we are facing. These are probably the most important questions of our time. How can civil liberties be protected? And should civil liberties be put above survival? Should civil liberties be put above survival? Because with all due respect to Benjamin Franklin, who said that liberty must be placed higher than security. Without security, without survival, what good are civil liberties? That's the problem. This crusade is going to lead us down roads we may not be comfortable going down, but we must go there. Page 86, scorched earth.
He literally called it a crusade. He goes on, by the way, in that clip to say, I want to team up with Donald Trump. I want to be in his administration if he wins, and we're going to do rallies, and at the rallies, I need everybody to hold their Bibles up in the air. That's what I want. You heard what he said there. So he's listing different organizations, the ACLU, the Council on American and Islamic Relations Care, and the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC. He says they're treasonous, and then he goes on to say, well, look, am I for political prisoners? Yeah, I'm for political prisoners. And he explains how in the name of freedom and democracy, we need to be undemocratic and anti-freedom because these groups are so bad and so wrong that it's for our security. And with all due respect to Benjamin Franklin, who said, you know, give me liberty or give me death, well, I think the opposite is true. Give me security before freedom, because security is a higher, more noble goal than freedom. This is what he's arguing. And by the way, this is something Chris Christie has argued before too, though Chris Christie, I honestly don't believe, is as insane as this guy is. But he's saying, yeah, civil liberties. What are you going to do? Chris Christie said, can you enjoy your civil liberties in a coffin? Saying the same thing. And he's using that point to then argue, well, we got to take political prisoners, and we got to restrict civil rights and civil liberties of the ACLU and CARE and the Southern Poverty Law Center and all these liberals. We have to go on a crusade against the liberals and lock them up because they're so dangerous and their ideas are so bad that we can't risk having them around here because we need security. So after we act in an undemocratic way and in a way that is anti-freedom and anti-liberty and anti-civil rights, well, then I'll say it's cool and we can have civil rights after that. Oh, well, isn't that fucking convenient? So after I already decide who all my enemies are and lock them up without a trial and no due process and no habeas corpus, and I lock them up simply because I disagree with them, well, then maybe, yeah, but we can have a conversation about, you know, being open and democratic again. No, this guy is really dangerous. He is. And this is, like, you know what it is? He's presenting it as if it's this new idea, as if it's something he came up with and it's totally original. And all he's doing is presenting the most basic, the most standard authoritarian argument I've ever heard. I mean, he's just flat out calling for authoritarianism and calling for fascism. But he thinks, because he's an idiot, he thinks, when I do it, it's not fascism and it's not authoritarian because I'm the good guy by definition. So when I do it, it's just out of necessity and because I had to do it. Don't you think that's the argument they use in all these other authoritarian regimes and fascist regimes? I mean, we had to do it. That's why we did it. It's like we didn't have a choice. We had to do it. No, you didn't have to do it. You never have to do it. You could actually abide by principles of freedom and liberty and justice and say, that's off the table. Those are guaranteed. Those are givens. And think about it. If we could, in the face of the Nazis, give them a legitimate trial and have due process in place to deal with them, the idea that, what, we can't have due process now for our various, you know, enemies and issues we face, of course we can, and we should. And that's what's supposed to be the idea of America and what's supposed to make us great and an open and free society. He's arguing for the exact opposite of that. And he's not even arguing to lock up fucking enemies. He's arguing to lock up the most American people who care the most about our system. I mean, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, who they're not even a left-wing organization. They're just for civil liberties. They defended the KKK and neo-Nazis at times because they wanted free speech rights to do a march through a, you know, various towns that were Jewish or black. So the guy is just – he's a scary, scary authoritarian person, and he should be nowhere near power. And he goes on to explain how he's been in contact with the Donald Trump people, and he's been sending them his book. That's what he's reading from there. And you know, maybe you let me in the administration if you win. Oh, you know, I once called Michael Savage the dumbest right wing radio host in the country, or the right wing commentator or pundit, and I stand by that. I was spot on. I nailed him when I originally said that. Okay. Next. All right, final story of the day, ladies and gentlemen. Got about 5 minutes here, maybe 6 minutes left.
RT has a story about a scientific breakthrough that came out this week. They say, American scientists have grown a liver which can manage the closest ever set of processes that to that of a real human one. The lab-grown organ has the potential to be a game-changer for patients suffering from liver diseases, they said. Scientists at the Sabin Research Institute of the Children's Hospital, Los Angeles, created the liver with the help of both people and mice. The study published in the journal Stem Cells Translational Medicine on Tuesday said, so they go on to explain here that they did use stem cells and progenitor cells, and as of now, the main issue that they're facing is that the tissue has a slightly different cellular structure than the naturally occurring tissue. But this is something that perhaps they'll iron out. And they, again, say this is a major, major breakthrough. And think about what you can do if you can basically regenerate or grow livers out of nowhere for people. So somebody could destroy their liver and then they're like, that's nice. Let me press a button and build you a new one and then fix your life. Ugh. That is unbelievable. And I hate to do it, except I don't hate to do it because I love to do it and I'm going to do it again. But do draw a parallel between this and between the way people used to try to fix serious issues like this. Prayer. I mean, that's what people would do. They have some sort of health issue, some sort of problem, psychological problem, whatever the problem is, material problem in their life. And what do? I don't know, get on your knees and say, God, please help me find a way to make this better. It's basically just wishing out loud, hoping out loud. That has a success rate of roughly 0.00%. Maybe I'm being unfair. Maybe we'll give it a 0.03% because some people convince themselves through some sort of placebo effect and then, okay, things feel a little better even though they're not really better, but you felt like it's better, so the end result is better. Whatever. So maybe that exists. No, but here we're talking about real-world solutions to real-world problems. And scientists are the unsung heroes of most of the good things we have. When you talk about modern technology, when you talk about medicine, when you talk about breakthroughs like this, it's the smart dudes in the fucking lab coats with the clipboards who've been working on it all along. And what do they prove? They prove there are no shortcuts. Like, there are no fucking shortcuts in life. Like, you have to buckle down, get serious, immerse yourself in a world of all this stuff in order to be successful in it and in order to get the answers. And this isn't just for medicine. This is for anything in life. You want to be successful in your career, whatever the fuck it happens to be. I know a lot of people want to be fucking actors and singers and all that shit. Like what? You think you just get up there and start singing one day and that's okay, there, I'm famous. It happened. No, it's fucking... You got to go out there and sing at every opportunity you can, and you got to be naturally good enough, and like all these different things go into it, and it's just natural talent, hard work, put together, busting your ass, single-minded in your pursuit of the goal, and then, you know, you come out the other end successful, and it works. And that's what's happening here. You have people who, it's just problem-solving one day after another day, and, you know, coming up with a hypothesis and testing the hypothesis and going through the scientific method and going, okay, we got it wrong this time. Okay, we got it wrong again. Oh, look at that. Maybe we're onto something. Okay, now we got it. Oh, my God, we can fucking regrow livers. What just happened? This is insane. Think about that, man. Think about that. Can you imagine telling somebody in 1850? You know, there's going to come a time when today, for example, somebody gets a face transplant. There's somebody who got a face transplant and he's living and just living a life now. 90. That's insanity. That is fucking insanity. Now, they're not perfect, but they're going to, over time, it's going to get better and better and better. You know, you talk about computers, you talk about artificial intelligence, the road we're going down with that. It just gets better and better and better. It's like exponential growth to getting better and better and better. And it's time to shed the skin of the past. The idea that, you know, you pray to God when something goes wrong, you do a fucking rain dance to try to get rain around a fire, all these goofy things that, and there are remnants of it still around today. All that is a primitive mindset holding us back from the actual potential for humanity. Now, there are downsides too. The downsides are humans get ahead of themselves, and we get technology that is scientifically advanced, even though we're not morally advanced as a species. So we create nuclear weapons, and then we use them. We can destroy the world with a few well-placed nuclear weapons. That's not good. That's not, so that's the downside. But you also have massive upsides in medicine and cures and technology and making lives better for everybody. And when you read stuff like this, you go, oh, isn't this a breath of fresh air? In a world of turmoil and death and destruction and horrible news all the time, there are some people in labs busting their ass, finding a way to fix people when something goes wrong. I salute them. That's all I have to say. All right, guys, I'm out of time. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Mwah. I'm out, lovelies. Peace.